The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
After an award-laden spring, which brought acclaim to the film adaptation of her novel Hamlet, my next guest hopes that summer will bring readers and critics alike to enjoy her new novel, which is called Land and which has just been published. Maggie O'Farrell, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you so much for having me, Pat.
Now, I've been lucky enough to have had a copy of your book for a few weeks now, so I've enjoyed it very much. And I realise the genesis of the novel is actually to be found within your own family. Will you tell us about your great-great-grandfather, Tomás?
Yes, with pleasure. We were always told as a child, as children, you know, and I think all families have their myths, that one of our antecedents drew the first ever map of Ireland as if he was just a lone man band, which obviously is very far from the truth. But I used to imagine, you know, as you can probably tell from the way I speak, I was born in Ireland, but I didn't grow up there. But we used to come back every summer and I would look out of the window of our little car at, I don't know, Kerry or Donegal or Galway going past. And I would imagine him as this lone person riding up a mountainside, probably with a kind of 20 centimetre ruler in his hand or something like that. But obviously that was a complete fantasy. And I did go looking for him slightly more seriously recently. And I went to the archives in Dublin hold the Ordnance Survey records for Ireland. And it took me a while to find him because if you work for the Ordnance Survey, which was, of course, a British government, British Army run organisation, and if you worked for them and you were Irish, you weren't allowed to sign your own work. It had to be signed by a British Army officer. So he was hard to find. But I did, in a list of labourers, underneath a memorandum about paid leave, I did find his signature. And it was an extraordinary moment, Pat, because it proved that actually there is a seed of truth in myth, that my family wasn't making this up. And also it was an amazing feeling to be touching a piece of paper that I knew he had touched at one point.
Mm. You also remarked, strangely, and it shows what DNA can do, that his handwriting was remarkably similar to your own.
Yes, I mean, actually, in those days, they all had this incredible kind of slanting, very beautiful copperplate script. I mean, I would love to say mine is as neat as that. It's not. But there was a weird similarity, certainly, to mine. Mine's a lot messier, I have to say.
But you'd already found a clue on a map that was framed of your uncle, which you'd overlooked, the whole family had overlooked, until you espied it.
Yes. So hanging in my parents' house, it was my uncle's who passed away and he left it to my dad. And so hanging in our house is a map drawn by, in the book, he's called Tomás and his son is called Liam, who's based on my great-grandfather. And so his son had drawn a map, which is in the style of an OS map of an imaginary place. And it's been hanging there for years and I've passed it hundreds of times back and forth. And one day, a few years ago, I don't really know why, I decided to look at it with a magnifying glass. And in the top corner of it is a little kind of medallion about the size of an old postage stamp. And when you look at it through a magnifying glass, you can see that there's a portrait inside it of my great-great-grandfather. And, I mean, it must have been done with a brush of maybe two or three bristles. It's so tiny. And he's standing behind a British soldier in a red coat, and the soldier is looking through a theodolite. And it was just astonishing because there he has been hiding in plain sight all these years. And it's quite a politically freighted portrait because standing behind Tomás looks quite anxious and the soldier is looking through a theodolite. And it was just, I was absolutely flabbergasted to find it there.
Now, it is set in the years post-famine and, you know, 30% of the population eliminated, whole villages decimated and falling to ruin. So what happened at the time, the Ordnance Survey wanted to update the reality of things on the ground, and your great-great-grandfather was one of those recruited by the Redcoats to do this work. It's an extraordinary time. I mean, echoed, I suppose, in Brian Friel's play Translations, which was talking about the same episode, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Ordnance Survey did their first, the first version of the map, and they started in 1820. And they originally thought it was going to take them 7 years to map Ireland. It actually took them over 22 years for many reasons, the project overran and overran. Partly because that when they first started, they had an edict that no Irish people were to be employed on the project. And they soon ran into lots of trouble with this because obviously the British Army had problems communicating with local people. And also it was run by the army. So local people were understandably quite alarmed when they saw a large army division suddenly, you know, roll into town. And I have read accounts that the British surveyors would spend, you know, days, perhaps even weeks, setting up their trig point, which is the point, you know, the sort of geographical location for ensuring that the measurements and the distances are accurate. So they would set it up. And I have read accounts of that sometimes during the night, locals would just move it a few feet just to mess with them. So obviously the project became very bogged down and very problematic. So they realised that they had to employ Irish people and particularly Irish speakers on this project. And my great-grandfather was one of them. And, you know, so the first map of Ireland was finished in the very early 1840s. And then, of course, as we all know, this enormous tragedy struck the country. And those maps, you know, among the many, many effects of the Great Hunger, the maps were obsolete because, as you say, the human and physical geography of Ireland was completely reconfigured. And so it was very important to almost straight away to make revisions to it. And so I realised that my great-great-grandfather began his employment with the OS in the later years of the famine, and that just stopped me in my tracks. I couldn't understand what that task must have been like, you know, to be setting down those villages that had been erased, the million people who died, between 1 million and 2 million people who'd been forced to emigrate. I mean, just, you know, to cartographically to make a record of that must have been a very, very difficult task.
And in the book, your great-great-grandfather, Tomás, is determined to try to retain elements of the land that might vanish under this new mapping system.
Yes. I mean, you know, obviously mapping is a very, very complicated task. I mean, it's, you know, part algebra, it's part mathematics, it's part linguistics, it's part history and folklore. And in Ireland, I think it was particularly complicated for, you know, political colonialist reasons. And I, you know, it was a question in my mind is what must it have been like to be an Irishman working on that project? And I think in a sense, I came to the conclusion that in a way, it was very, very good that Irishmen did work on it because otherwise so much would have been lost. You know, so much of the linguistic and folkloric and historical roots of names would have been lost if they hadn't. And there was a toponymy branch that had been set up in Dublin by a man called John O'Donovan, who was an Irish language scholar, and he insisted on absolute rigor in place names and meanings and their connection to the land and these towns and settlements past.
And of course, when we have anglicised versions of those names now, we can trace their origins to maybe the topography of the land in which they are situated, which is great. But it reminds me, strangely in a different way, of Donald Trump. He goes to America. Well, his family goes to America, and they were Drumpfs, Drumfts. They were Drumpfs. And of course, it got changed for convenience, I suppose, to Trump.
I never knew that.
Yeah, and all of these things, I suppose, happened in Ireland as well. That things were shortened, that things were written the way they sounded rather than the way they might have been written in Irish, for example.
Yes, absolutely. But you can still find those traces, you know, any place name that has the word Tubber in it, you know that there is a sacred well somewhere in that settlement. You know, I love looking at a map of places, particularly, you know, I think Ireland has got one of the best preserved pre-Christian pagan folkloric past, partly because possibly it was never invaded by the Romans, so the sort of history and folklore and deities were never merged with the Roman. So you can look at a map and you can kind of guess what's happened or what kind of place it might be just from the names, which I find really thrilling.
Kildara, I presume, is the Church of the Oaks.
Oh, yes, that's right. And Rath, of course, you know, Rath appears everywhere, and that means an old Iron Age hill fort.
Now, we've been concentrating on, if you like, the technical aspects of the endeavour of Tomás and ultimately, well, I don't want to give too much away about Liam's activities in all of this, but it is primarily a family drama, a saga. It is a family tragedy, I suppose, in so many ways. How much do you want to tell us about the narrative? Because there are so many threads running through the individual lives.
Well, on the one hand, I wanted to write a book that was about a family who are endeavouring to survive and thrive and come out from the long shadow of the Great Hunger. But also, on the other hand, I was interested in trying to tell the whole story of Ireland right from the very first settlers, just via one peninsula and all the people, all the different waves of people who've lived upon it. You know, I suppose it was I liked the contrast between the huge, vast timescale of a landscape and the sort of almost butterfly lives of humans who live upon it.
Now, the job you've given yourself to capture 19th century Ireland, you gave yourself the job of capturing 16th century Italy in The Marriage Portrait, and of course in Hamlet, Elizabethan England. You don't make things easy for yourself.
Well, I think if a book feels easy to write, it's going to be a bad book, Pat. You know, I think you need to set yourself new hurdles. And I was, you know, I was really apprehensive about, or nervous about writing this book, partly because I was worried that I was, and I'm not Irish enough. You know, I could hear myself in my very British accent thinking about this and talking about this book. And so I was nervous about that. But in the end, it was just a story that wouldn't go away. You know, it was just something that kept tugging at my sleeve. And I just couldn't get my great great grandfather out of my head, and I just wanted to explore his story and his life and his work.
Now, you say you're apprehensive about how little Irish you may sound, and yet, you know, your lineage is entirely Irish, born in Coleraine. Your dad was a dub.
He was. He said, and very much still is. I think he's one of those immigrants who's never quite got over leaving Ireland. I mean, he said only the other day that he's thinking about moving back, and we had to say, Dad, you're 85. Is that a good idea?
Yeah, but I mean, he was the one, in spite of the fact that he came from Dublin, and I presume suburban Dublin, that he was telling you all of these folk tales and keeping the mythology of Ireland alive for you as a child.
Yeah, absolutely. So my dad would only ever read Irish myths to us when we were kids. And we used to kind of beg him, you know, please, can you read us Pippi Longstocking or whatever? And he never would. He insisted on only reading Irish myth. And I mean, I used to find it annoying at the time, but now I'm actually really glad that he did, because I think those stories, those cycles, the plots of battles and giants and long feuds, and also that whole sort of atmosphere and the tropes of those myths have really formed a kind of bedrock of narrative in my head, you know. And I've always been really fascinated in the sort of seeds of truth in myth. You know, I find it fascinating that there's so many giants in Irish myth, and it's also a country that was very much invaded and influenced by the Hiberno Norse, who presumably looked a little bit like giants when they arrived. So I think, you know, it's very kind of present in my mind, and I really wanted to have as much of that kind of animism of the land and the landscape and the natural world being alive and vocalized and being able to alter the lives of human characters as happens in Irish myth.
I'm wondering, therefore, who was reading you bedtime stories about Lucrezia de Medici, which gave rise to The Marriage Portrait?
Imagine if my parents had read me stories about the Medici's and murders. Now, that came a little bit later in life, Pat, I'm happy to say.
Tell me this, are you over the whole Hamnet hype?
Do you know, it's so strange. It all feels now, as particularly the whole kind of awards season, as they call it, it all feels like some really strange fever dream. You know when on your phone something comes up and it says 2 months ago and there was a picture of me standing on a balcony in LA, and I thought, what? Oh, yeah, I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. I went to the Oscars. It's quite hard, you know, when it's nothing to do with your real life, it sort of feels like something that you imagined in a way.
Well, that is a chapter in the past. But, of course, I think Land has been optioned to become a movie, perhaps.
Yeah, so it's been bought by the same producer who bought Hamlet, actually, in manuscript, a woman called Liza Marshall. And it's really wonderful to know, because I really trust Liza and I really trust her vision. She's very good at putting together a team of creative people to bring a story to the screen. So it's very early days, but yes, it's quite exciting.
Now, it turns out that I will never be able to address you as Maggie O'Farrell, OBE. You turned it down.
I did, Pat. Yes. I mean, I was very pleased to be asked. It was a really nice letter to receive. But I just knew it wasn't for me. You know, two reasons, really. I mean, the E in OBE, I have a bit of a problem with that. I stumble over that and I wouldn't.
That's the Empire.
Yes, I can't imagine that being part of my name. But also, you know, what I said in my letter back to them, I said that I was very honoured to be asked, but I was going to turn it down because, and I wrote this in my letter, that so Charles Trevelyan, who I'm sure doesn't need any introduction.
Memorialised in the fields of Athenry, they stole Trevelyan's corn that they might see the morn.
That's right. So Charles Trevelyan was appointed famine officer for the Irish famine. And in 1847, which, as you know, was Black 47, he wrote a letter that described the great hunger as a punishment from God for an idle, unself-reliant, ungrateful country. I mean, all I'm going to say is that a year later, he was given the highest order of knighthood. So what I said in my letter to the very kind OBE people was that I can't accept an honour that still honours him. You know, I don't think he should have been given that knighthood. And I would really quite like it if they revoked it. And I think they should, I think, as an act of respect.
So we'll have to wait for Dame Maggie O'Farrell then.
No, I don't. I would be very surprised if I turned down an OBE. They offered me another one, Pat. I think maybe that ship has sailed now, which is fine by me.
Well, the latest book is simply called Land. It's just out. It's in all the bookshops right now. And it's author Maggie O'Farrell without an OBE. Maggie, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.